Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with regional and national writers from North State Public Radio. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
Local author Katie Simmons is a Deputy Chief Administrative Officer for Butte County. She supported disaster recovery after the Camp Fire and worked in local nonprofits, including the Chico Chamber of Commerce, for many years. In addition to working on long-term disaster recovery for the county on the Camp Fire, North Complex Fire, and Park Fire, Katie Simmons also oversees emergency management. She participated in a policy fellowship with Stanford University on wildfire recovery, which is the basis of her book, Three Fire Mountains, Stories of Wildfire and Recovery in California. Katie Simmons, welcome.
Thank you, Nancy. Thanks so much for having me.
You know, a lot of times I'd read something in your book and I would reread it several times. What? Did she say that? So, for example, in chapter one, I read the first couple of sentences in that. Would you read that for us?
Sure. Recovery begins before fire even starts. It is shaped by who we are, how we feel, and what we think. Recovery is made up of the stuff that gets into our bones when we're children and defines how safe we feel and what choices we make. For me, recovery began in kindergarten.
So I read that recovery begins before fire even starts?
Yes.
Wow. And then, for you, recovery began in kindergarten. How is that possible, Katie?
Well, thank you so much for the question. I am a disaster service worker through the county, and so this is really my perspective as a disaster worker. But I've learned so much about myself entering this field. And when I started to sort of peel back the layers, like, how did I get here? Why did I sign up for this? I realize that it's because I have a heart for, I'm drawn to things that are hard. I'm drawn to things that are painful, particularly for other people. And I want to fix and I want to help.
Well, you tell, you say something else in your book that I found curious. This was midway through kindergarten, and you say, before we moved out of town with my mom, I found a magazine in a friend's bathroom. And what was that? How did that influence you?
Well, what I write is, staring back at me from the magazine cover were children with no performative expression. They were emaciated in very little clothing, maybe not children at all, and I felt shame studying their bones, eyes, and teeth. I flipped through the pages thinking there must be some mistake. These photos couldn't possibly be real. Seeing suffering on a scale I didn't know existed bewildered me, and I felt the first of many tugs to act on behalf of somebody else's pain.
So you, even as a kid, you felt you should do something.
Compelled.
Compelled, yeah. And then you say, four decades later,
yep.
A year after the Tubbs Fire shook Santa Rosa, the Camp Fire turned that tug into a life-changing decision. That magazine cover may be the whole reason for this story.
Yes. Yes. So I've had the opportunity through writing this book to like I said, go back into really my history as a person and really examine, like, what are my beliefs and what am I compelled to do and what are my fears and what is my ambition? All of that has, like, just come under a microscope almost for me to understand how I was drawn into disaster recovery and why I really stay.
My guest is Katie Simmons, and her book is Three Fire Mountains, Stories of Wildlife and Recovery in California. And you say something else that I find interesting that, like I say, I say, what, Katie? Did she really write that? And that is housing. I mean, if there's a fire, housing is a big problem.
It's the first.
That's the very first.
Even if it's the first thing you can't do, it is the first thing you need, right? So,
Yeah. But then you say, before housing, though, cows.
Cows.
Yes. Cows, Katie?
Cows. Yes. Thank you so much for noticing that this book is a little bit quirky. it was really important to me to honor my thoughts and my heart and, you know, in the process of really kind of understanding wildfire recovery with Stanford University, there were so many things that I wanted to say, and I wanted to talk about cows. Here's why. In 2022, I was on the Farm City Tour hosted by the Butte County Farm Bureau, and Dave Daly is a sixth-generation cattle rancher in Butte County, and he was speaking to our group and shared a very heartbreaking story about having to go on a search and rescue mission for his cows following the North Complex fire. And I stood there, and it was like, it was the first time that I realized how deeply my heart was broken on the campfire. He was talking about his experience with North Complex, but it touched in me just the suffering of animals, obviously the suffering of people, the suffering of our habitat, our natural environment, our communities. He shared his story, and it touched me in a place where I was like, oh my goodness, my heartbreak is way deeper than I even knew. And this was a couple of years into my disaster recovery career. And what I realized is, until I sort of reconciled and made peace almost with how deep my heart was broken, then I would continue to sort of suffer in the job.
I think so many of us that are animal lovers are just touched like you are. It just breaks our heart.
It does.
To see that. But it does, I have a little bit of hope now that people are more aware of, we've got to take care of our animals when there's a fire.
Yes.
Don't you think that people have a better notion now, a better understanding?
For sure. I mean, I think we've learned a lot, unfortunately, the hardest way possible, right? So. Yeah. And I know working with emergency management at the county, how important it is for preparedness and thinking about pets is certainly part of that. I think what got to me with regard to the cows was how helpless they were out there in the forest roaming because they knew the area. And, you know, it was such a symbol of how we're just going about our daily lives, doing what we normally do. And suddenly here comes something that that just sort of outruns us. And so there was something about that story that finally allowed me to go, okay, my heart is broken in a way I just hadn't comprehended before.
Well, speaking of your heart, mm-hmm. I was amused that you said, because you didn't grow up in Paradise, but you moved there in 2008. Mm-hmm. And your words were love at first sight.
Yeah, absolutely. I still remember driving up Skyway with my parents, and I was in the backseat of the car, and I had Adela with me, and she was a toddler. And
Your daughter now, too.
Yeah. Yes, my daughter Adela. She's now 21. So, but driving up, being driven up Skyway and looking really to the left and seeing Butte Creek Canyon, and I was like, I was shocked. I thought, how is this happening in California? It felt like the Grand Canyon, right? So geographically, yeah. it was surprising. But then we crested into Paradise, and I got my first trip up to Paradise was literally to go to Johnny Appleseed Days. And I walked into the festival, and I was like, what is this magical place? And yes, it was love at first sight.
My guest is Katie Simmons. Her book is Three Fire Mountains. And something that amused me, I'm sure it was not amusing to you at the time, but when I was growing up, my older brother, who became a veterinarian, but before he became a veterinarian, he could demusk skunks.
Okay.
Skunks. He could demusk skunks.
Yes, wow.
And so a picture of my younger brother appeared in the local paper with a skunk sitting on top of his head. I didn't think anything about it because skunks are very cute pets.
I mean, yes.
But... you have a different view of skunks.
I certainly do. So I just love what you're picking out of the book. When I lived in Paradise, I heard scratching underneath the bathtub in the bathroom. And I was like, what is that scratching sound? And Adela was taking baths regularly. And I was like, very creeped out. I was like, what is under the house scraping the tub? And couldn't figure it out. It would kind of happen on and off. And then one night, you know, we went to bed and I was shocked awake by the smell of skunk like in my mouth. And I was like, I burst out of bed and I ran and I opened the front door and I stood out in the night and I was like, wait a minute, it doesn't smell like skunk outside the house, but it does inside. Anyway, called animal control. They discovered that a female skunk in heat had nested in the walls of the bathroom. And the scratching was probably her nesting, but also the males coming in and having skirmishes and spraying inside the walls of the house. And so we worked with animal control for a period of time. They set up, you know, cages, and I never, from cows now to skunks, I never want to harm any creatures. But they ended up catching 15 skunks.
That's what was so shocking. 15 skunks.
And we weren't even done. The female was still bedded, and the animal control said, and I said also, like, pull the traps. And of course, I was working with my landlord. I was like, pull the traps, because this was not stopping. And anyway, so we caught 3 raccoons also accidentally. They were kind of shoved. I remember looking at them in the morning and we're like, so sorry. But yeah, what animal control told me is once a skunk beds or nests, it will return to that spot every time it goes into heat. And I was like, oh dear. So that was my skunk experience that I write about in the book.
Yeah, well, I couldn't help but laugh because my experience with skunks was they're cute.
Sure. I mean, sure, they are kind of cute, but they're smelly.
Yes. Also, I might mention that maybe part of the appeal here in this part of California is you're a bike rider.
Yes. Yeah.
And you still bike.
I do. I have a mountain bike. And I really found cycling as an adult in paradise, kind of going up and down the hills and riding on the bike path. And I had Adela in a little bike trailer, and we'd cruise around paradise. And it really was moving here to Butte County, living in paradise, that I discovered the joys of, like, flying down, you know, safely with a helmet, yes. You know, my bike. And I've really gotten into cycling and learned a lot about it. And now I just do sort of easy trail rides. You know, I'm not technical or, you know, skillful, but I do love riding my bike, and Butte County's a great place for it.
You know, all the more reason, knowing all this that we've just talked about, was what you did before you moved to paradise in 2008. This in your chapter 8, you call this homemade home. Mm-hmm. And I think people would be surprised. My goodness, how is she even old enough to have had the past experience that had?
Well, I certainly feel old enough. But when I was in the Bay Area, I had the great pleasure of serving as convention director for the International Society for Magnetic Resonance in Medicine. That's a mouthful, ISMRM. And it was the International MRI Association. And so we traveled between North America, Asia, Europe, all over the world doing large conventions for delegations from dozens of countries. And then I did small workshops for the doctors and for board meetings and those kinds of things. But I really had the opportunity to see the world in my 20s through traveling with ISMRM. And I got to have all kinds of, you know, really interesting experiences. And then when I moved to paradise, and everything became very local, so I went from this international job.
Yeah, you described only in nine days. Do you remember all the different countries you went to?
Yeah,
in
okay,
that trip?
So let's see. Singapore, Hong Kong, Kuala Lumpur, Melbourne, Brisbane, Australia, I think there was one other, Seoul, Korea. So I used to really travel the world a lot, and my passport tells a story, which is a great memento. But I did get to travel a lot. And so
you said in Frankfurt, you better leave yourself a lot of time.
Oh, yeah, because you're running between. Yeah. And then they drop you off on the tarmac and you'd be like, where am I? And then you have to catch a shuttle and then run still. Oh, my gosh, I have so many travel stories. But that was a great way to spend my 20s. And then I literally went from that job, from that international convention director job with ISMRM in Berkeley. We were headquartered in Berkeley at the time. I moved to Paradise and became the executive director of the Paradise Chamber. And there was so much, like, adjusting that I had to do. But I went from living this very urban life where I was commuting and traveling to paradise where I was very localized and my job was focused on the local business community and community events. And it was, like, absolute whiplash. But I am so glad that I had that experience because I just would not know the difference between sort of the urban environment and urban needs and deeply rural concerns. And I feel like sometimes having that dual experience, when I work with consultants, I can sort of normalize and help them understand. I feel like this, you know, translator almost sometimes when they're coming in from outside of the area and they're like, what's happening here? And I just, you know, and not in a negative way, but I can really explain like, oh, I think I know where you're coming from and where you're getting stuck.
Oh, yeah.
And so, and let me explain. And I'm so, so grateful, endlessly grateful that I am having this experience, like having experienced both and having this hyper international job to this hyper local job where I literally commuted about a half mile between Adela's preschool and my job and my house. Like I just went in this little triangle, you know, that was like the sum total of my life was just this very, very tiny little, you know, experience. But it ingrained me into the community. I knew more people in the town of Paradise within a very short time than I ever met in 30 years in the Bay Area. I had relationships that were deeper and meaningful. I got to experience like expectations of communities. I got to see how they govern. And I mean, I feel like I got to have this deep experience from the inside of the town of Paradise, particularly working for the chamber and so closely with the town. And it really was an education for me. And I think it makes me stronger and more sensitive in understanding rural concerns in comparison to urban concerns and really being a good advocate for our area.
You give an example that the trash didn't get picked up.
Yes.
And the guy says, oh, well, I'll call Tom.
I know. I was shocked. I was shocked. So my office manager, Lisa, if you're listening, she was amazing. But she, you know, the trash didn't get picked up. And I was like, well, you know, those are the breaks. Sort of like you don't in the Bay Area. You call no one. There is no one to call. Like, and she got on the phone and she's like, Tom, Bill forgot the trash. Send it back. And I was like, what? What is happening here? And so really the scale of life and the relationships, the deep relationships and the history so many people had with each other, I was definitely an outsider, but I was like, oh, this is something very special.
My guest is Katie Simmons, and she has written a book. The title is Three Fire Mountains, Stories of Wildfire and Recovery in California. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Katie Simmons, whose book is Three Fire Mountains, Stories of Wildfire and Recovery in California. And that's what I appreciate, the fact that you weren't somebody, some administrator coming in from your office in even Sacramento or farther to make decisions about people you didn't even know or know what their life was like.
Mm-hmm.
And here you've had experiences that I would appreciate your experience and your background knowing this is what life is like here.
Yes. I mean, I think that's why ultimately I was compelled to accept the job as disaster recovery director, which I only held for a year. And it's taken me a long time to understand secondary trauma and kind of give myself grace for that. But I ultimately said yes to that position. It sounded very daunting. And also I was very worried that it would be, you know, to be honest, depressing to sort of see this community that I loved so much struggle so much. But I ultimately said yes to that, because of really, truly, deeply how much I loved the town of Paradise and the people. And I think really who I was as a person saying, I'm compelled by these things and I think I can help. So it's almost like one of the greatest disappointments of my life that I was only able to stay for a year before I was really suffering. But I've, you know, managed interestingly to kind of stay in the work and stay in touch with people. And at the county, our responsibilities are, you know, long-term recovery and emergency management for the unincorporated jurisdiction. So obviously, you know, certainly with Park Fire North Complex, we've seen how devastating these fires can be to our small unincorporated communities. And so I'm still very much in it. But yeah, I was almost disappointed that I had to leave, but now I understand myself a little bit better.
Now, you use the word trauma, and it seems people deal with that differently, even your husband.
Yes.
His reaction was different. How was his reaction different from, say, yours?
Well, we've had to actually process that a lot. In writing this book, it allowed me to kind of have conversations with my family members because I was like, you know, I really compartmentalize. I don't talk about the fires at home, but it's literally all I do every day at work. Every second of every day, we are working on the, you know, the fires or preparedness. And so doing this, you know, project, I was able to talk with him and you know, he is someone who very opposite to me. He enmeshes himself in news, in, you know, clicks and, you know, he'll listen to the police scanner and he'll be on social media and he just absorbs it all, right? And I have recognized I'm just too sensitive for that. So I'm very focused on work and then I try to have, you know, boundaries, I would say local news accepting. But he really went all in, like deeply all in to what are people talking about? What are they saying? What do we need to know? He just went all in. And ultimately what we've decided is our two different approaches. We probably want to be on the same page if this ever happens again. We want to evacuate together, right? So he stayed home. I took the kids during campfire evacuation, and then North Complex, I asked my parents to take the kids out of town, and you know we've kind of managed with each incident, and my kids left town for air quality and you know all sorts of things, but he hung back and was like, I made a pact with the neighbor, and we would you know evacuate if we needed to, and that was just not my experience. I was like, we have to get the kids out of town, and so we've talked about our differences in going through the fires and in our thoughts during you know right after the campfire in particular, and how we might do things differently now, more unified as a family. But I think when there's certain things to your point earlier, when things like this happen, that you may be expecting, you know, an incident or an emergency or a fire, but nothing like this. And so I think this probably shocked a lot of people into, you know, fight or flight, right? And then maybe in retrospect, like, oh, maybe I would do things a little bit differently. And of course, you know, our house didn't burn. And so we don't have those additional experiences and memories and considerations to play into our plan. But we definitely handled it very, very differently, and we've decided we want to be more on the same page going forward. You know, I've told them, I'm like, I think you're going to leave with us next time. And now I work through incidents. I'm in EOC, Emergency Operations Center for the county. So when we have an incident, I respond as a disaster service worker. But, you know, that really puts him in the seat of being responsible for the kids and the pets and those kinds of things. So I feel like going through this a couple of times, we're very much more on the same page.
Yeah, because people are probably wondering, well, did Katie, did she suffer any consequences of the fire in Paradise, the Paradise fire? Did that affect you? And you were right there.
I was right there. I mean, you know, my parents lost they live in Butte Creek Canyon, and their house survived, which my mom has said a number of times, and they lost their outbuildings. So all of the family heirlooms, the classic car, literally everything my mom had collected and was meaningful for her, for family history. She'd lost both of her parents by that point. My stepdad had lost his brother. So they had this incredible collection of like meaningful items in the outbuildings. And then in their house, they just had day-to-day spatulas, soap, washcloths, you know, those kinds of things. Yeah. And they lost everything that meant something to them. But their house remained. The fire, campfire burned. I think I talk about in the book, like it singed the succulents on their porch, but left their house intact and then burned everything else. And so I watched my parents have to itemize their insurance claim in a process that was very re-traumatizing for them. And, you know, I watched them, you know, have debris removal and then all of the you know, and ultimately it took them 5 years to replace one outbuilding on their property. It took them 5 years to decide we want to build a covered carport on our property. And they had impacts far less than so many other households who truly lost, you know, everything. And so I've been proximate to a lot of these experiences, and certainly in disaster recovery, working with, you know, working through the hazardous tree removal program in the town. And so this is my reflection as a disaster worker, and knowing and being deeply ingrained in, you know, working with survivors. But I sort of feel like this story needs to be told from the practitioner perspective, because I really encourage us to add our voices to, you know, discussion on wildfire recovery.
You know, one thing that struck me, too, that you say, I think maybe it's around the office, that communities that haven't burned yet. Oh, my gosh. So it's expected. I mean, we'd be surprised that a community does not suffer from these disasters that you work with, that you talk about communities that haven't burned yet.
Yes. So that is an acknowledgement of vulnerability, I think, more than anything. And in emergency management, preparedness is a big push, right? Like that is, you know, education, outreach, preparedness. We're doing so many projects right now to help people, you know, recover in place and then prepare within their homes. And, you know, we just have so many projects focused on preparedness. And so, you know, when I say things like that, it's never a hope or a wish. I don't want anyone to misunderstand.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
But it's like making sure we're not turning the other cheek, you know, and saying, oh, well, we've experienced those fires, but we're sort of, you know, we don't want to become complacent. And I'll tell you, I'm up in communities all the time working on mitigation. Next week, actually, we'll be up in McGillie and Cohasset with these mitigation plans, getting public input. But, you know, I want to make sure, and it's not just me. I don't want you to hear that. Obviously, we've got, our incredible board and our staff. But, you know, we can't just sort of say, well, the worst has happened and we're going to, you know what I mean? Like, we have to prepare and be ready and sort of keep our eyes on the horizon, our ears to the ground. And I talk a lot about how that feels as a disaster worker, and also, you know, in our engagement with the community. And we want to be very realistic. But I do want to distinguish, that's not a hope or a wish. it's just a sort of acknowledgement of risk and wanting to be ready.
My guest is Katie Simmons. Her book is Three Fire Mountains: Stories of Wildfire and Recovery in California. And you say in your book that writing this book allowed memories to loosen their grip on you.
Mm-hmm. Wow, did it ever. I've been asked, now that I've written this, if I feel better, right?
Yeah.
And my response has been that when I went through the editing process for this, and I went through several rounds and before I submitted it to the publisher for the final time, when I was editing, my memories of the things that I had written about, you know, many months ago were less sharp. And so I feel like I have a very, my memory comes across like as a picture. I can describe things exactly how I see them in my mind, which is what I did when I wrote this. But then even going back and editing, I was like, wow, that detail, I'm starting to let go of it, which means to me I'm getting a little bit of distance from the things that I was holding onto so tightly. And so is it healing? You know, I guess that sort of remains to be seen. I think in talking about the book and in talking about my experiences opens the door for other people to share their experiences with me and their stories, and allows us to sort of, you know, I guess share, and storytelling is a big part of my life, and I appreciate this opportunity with this book. So I don't know. I guess I wouldn't know if it's healing yet, but I think over time, I certainly could not reproduce this now, having done it already, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. So why this book now?
Well, goodness, I will never forget stepping into the town of Paradise as disaster recovery director. It was deep COVID. It was May of 2021. And I was like, oh, okay, well, then I need to immerse myself in all the publicly available information on Camp Fire. And what a mistake that was. So I sat alone in an office and just watched all the, like, Datelines and all the shows, right? And I just immersed myself in that. And I was like, well, this, that doesn't feel great. And then as I started to realize the enormity of the responsibilities and the projects that we were doing and the long road ahead, I was like, where's the soft place to land? Like, this is a lot to carry. And I'm not overwhelmed, but it was a lot. And I wrote this book for anybody who steps into this role in the future anywhere to say that this is very hard work. The contradictions within state and federal policy around funding itself is shocking. And you can experience secondary trauma, or you can be a survivor yourself doing disaster work, as we certainly know in our region. People have those, you know, are both. And I wanted to say, this is so hard, so that if anyone else steps in and says, this is so hard, they almost can be in communion with me, if that makes sense. Like, just in the same way Dave Daly shared his cow story, I was like, I want to share some stories because I believe those are bridges for other people to share theirs. And I think that this particular story, if it had existed when I, not my story, I don't know if that makes any sense, but like, if I had read someone say, this is hard, it feels impossible, and it doesn't work all the time, and you have recovery rage, and there's contradictions in policy, and you get told no more often than yes, and, you know, all those sorts of things, like, it would kind of normalize it for me. So I feel like for disaster workers who are faced with the daunting task of wildfire recovery, I almost want to say, these are the things that the federal and state manuals don't tell you about recovery. They want to tell you about success stories. I'm going to tell you what it's really like on the ground when you're working through and navigating all of these things, so that sort of to kind of reduce the shock and the despair and the dismay and maybe even the recovery rage, and just to say, oh, yeah, this is really hard. But I'm signing up for this, and here's how I'm going to carry myself through this, or here's the support I'm going to seek for myself in this job, because, you know, you are vulnerable to, you know, to all the things that you experience when a disaster has occurred. So why now? I really wish I had something like this when I entered the field. And I certainly hope that if this book makes it to any hands at all, it's into the hands of people who are bewildered when they enter this field and they're like, what is actually going on? Because I sure thought things would be different, and they're harder than I could ever have imagined.
Katie's book, Katie Simmons, Three Fire Mountains, Stories of Wildfire and Recovery in California. Now, you mentioned a fellowship, and you got a fellowship. This is Stanford University. And why did it feel important to do this recovery fellowship now?
Well, good question. So I was reading my email one day, and I saw an opportunity to apply for this fellowship through Stanford University. And of course, I thought it was spam, so I just deleted. And then the email came in again from the same person, like, one more week to apply. Are you dealing with something very hard at work? I was like, wait a minute. Yes, I am. And so, of course, you know, I sought the review and approval of my boss at the county, and, you know, had her support to apply. And I thought the fellowship would go in a totally different way. I was like, oh, this will be very straightforward. They'll help me gather data. I'll have an evidence-based theory on disaster recovery. And I got into it, and I was brittle and broken. And what came out was stories about skunks and cows and magazine covers and all those other things. And it's like, I had a great experience. I had fabulous advisors. They were very patient with me. as I strayed into opinion and anecdote. You know, they were kept trying to bring me back to the data, and I was like, yes, but, you know, I also am someone in my position who hears from a lot of academics, and they're like, well, we've studied your disasters, and this is how we think you should recover. And it's just not at all in alignment with our infrastructure capacity and our finances and, you know, public, you know, land ownership rights and all these sorts of things. So I also knew that I didn't want to push paper and push data too hard against this issue. I wanted to talk about how it feels on the inside and how you might use data to sort of make sense of almost like a compass a little as one of the tools in the toolboxes. And so, and I was the first cohort. Stanford University has gone on and they're in their second cohort now. But the other question, are you dealing with something hard at work? I was like, we sure are.
You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My guest is Katie Simmons, and she and I will be back to continue our conversation after a short break. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Katie Simmons. Her book is Three Fire Mountains. So I've been trying to figure out, okay, who do you hope will read the book? Because it seems like all of us here in California, but more specifically, who do you think should be reading your book?
Yeah, who did I write this for?
Yeah.
I mean, I think I wrote it for the people here who have suffered through recurrent catastrophic wildfire. I wrote this for us because I wanted to say, I hear us, I see us, I experience us, and here is a record. But having gone to conferences with other recovery professionals and certainly Butte County gets calls from other areas that are suffering, catastrophic wildfire. I'm hoping that there are certain things in here that, like I said, both normalize the experience of disaster recovery, but also help people understand how they can be more powerful within these roles, certainly at the local level, in terms of advocacy and storytelling and, you know, just being very almost surgical with public comment letters on policy contradictions.
How insensitive for somebody to say that.
I know. I know. I talk a little bit about some of the responses that I've gotten and some of the hardship that I've had to navigate just in trying to push some of these stories forward. So, you know, I think this book is for anyone who I really don't know, Nancy. I've thought a lot about it. Of course, I've had people close to me read it, and they have said that they think, you know, it might be I don't want it to be re-traumatizing for anyone because I talk about the fires. And so I certainly understand there's going to be plenty of people who are like, if it's about this topic, no thanks for me. Like, I totally understand. And I have heard that from people, and I fully respect it. But I wonder if for some people it might be a little bit healing. And also, I'm hoping it's, like I said, not instructive, because when people say I'm an expert on disaster recovery, I'm like, no, there's just no way to be an expert on this field for sure. But I hope it at least plants a couple of seeds in the minds of people working on disasters in other areas, whether it's fire or not, around how I believe we should start to sort of frame this up and talk about it a little bit differently. It's very policy driven at this point. And I would like to see the conversation shift a little bit more to adapt to the reality, certainly of rural California, but also to make it easier, make it a little more possible, I guess, to utilize the federal funds that we have for recovery, both intended for survivor assistance and for local government.
Yeah, I think for survivors and for disaster workers.
Yes, yeah. Yes.
Well, the word trauma has come up often in our conversation. And why is trauma so much a part of your book?
Well, I just think trauma is very understudied when it comes to wildfire recovery. I talk to a lot of consultants and have to sort of prepare them for encountering trauma in the field. And you might be surprised or not how many consultants are like, I don't even know what you mean by that. And I have to explain, you know, how traumatizing fire is and how we need to sensitize our language and how we avoid even certain words to make sure we don't trigger. I reduce all use of disaster imagery for sure. I find disaster imagery, I think in the book I sort of acknowledge it as disassociation. If I see a picture of a catastrophic fire, particularly one that's about to burn a home, I mean, my brain just completely leaves and I have to like really bring it back and say, oh yeah, that's right, I'm in an EOC training and I need to pay attention. It's very challenging. And so I look at the impact of like language and imagery and messaging on myself. And I try to make sure that consultants are being very sensitive to, you know, what is triggering for both disaster workers and potentially for survivors, just based upon the feedback that I've gotten and sort of been part of over the last several years. And so trauma, I think I called it at some point in the book, kind of an inconvenient truth, because
yes,
nobody's
did.
Talking about it. Yeah. I work with so many agencies on disaster recovery. They're funding it. They're writing policy. They're implementing, you know, federal regulations or whatever. Nobody is talking about trauma. And we have seen time and time again that a survivor can have every resource they need, but they can have, you know, trauma that is unseen, unacknowledged, untended to.
So did it show up in your research?
It did. So I use them as sort of my, my samples, you know, and I just watched how stuck they were the first year and how hard it was for them to take in information and how it took them many years to even be on the same page together as a twosome around rebuilding a garage on their property. And I was like, and that was not because, that was because of how hurt and sort of unhealed I think they were, maybe. But I've seen that time and time again through my recovery work, through, working with survivors. And I think trauma is like this invisible truth that just lives. It's like, I think I call it at one point like the driving hand of recovery, and nobody's talking about it. And I think that it should be brought up to the surface and it should be acknowledged in policy. And we should try harder to understand the impact of that on survivors and on disaster workers. And, you know, just like I said, you can have all the resources in the world. And if you don't, if your heart is broken and you don't believe good things can happen for you following disaster, or you mistrust, or, you know, who knows what it is, if your hurt is holding you back, then throwing resources is just not going to solve the problem. And so someone said to me recently, well, how have you dealt with trauma after the campfire? And of course, they weren't talking to me. This is a responsibility shared by many people. This is, I hope I'm representing that well. That's not just me. But I said, even in my own experience and even in watching my family and in working with survivors, trauma, you cannot quantify it right away. You can't. It takes years to go, oh my goodness, it took me, someone working like in the epicenter of it, for a couple of years to have a little bit of training to go, oh my goodness, I think I'm traumatized. Like, and I feel pretty tuned in and pretty plugged in, and I was missing it. And so how much are we missing it? I don't know, but I think it's a big piece of the work.
Well, if we want to call this an industry, why are these practitioners, recovery practitioners, needed to design this industry?
Well, goodness. I wish I had a whiteboard, Nancy. I would whiteboard this and then the listeners would be lost. But, you know, you have a federal appropriation or you have federal funds coming, right? And two federal agencies, say, offer funding for the same project, and one is the primary funding source and one is the match. And then those federal funding sources from those two agencies pass through two different agencies at the state, and then ultimately they pass down to the local jurisdiction. The local jurisdiction is the only one of all of those parties who knows what the different sets of rules are, who knows why they don't work, who knows what the barriers are to utilizing those funds, because those federal agencies are not talking. Those state agencies are not necessarily talking. And it all sort of funnels down to local government, who's like, how am I supposed to use match funding that expires before your primary funding source is even approved? Or how are we supposed to move a project together when it requires two different environmental processes that don't align or don't require the same things of the project? Like, local government, I'm telling you, because I sit in all of these meetings, we are the only ones, because of the funnel that we sort of, through which we receive policy and funding and requirements, and we have to comply with all these regulations, we're the only one who knows why things don't work, because everybody else is working within their own bubble and saying, well, here's our funding and here's our funding and here's our policies. And we're like, none of this matches. None of this aligns. And so I feel very much like local government is the recipient of a lot of maybe ideas on how recovery should occur. And I feel like we deserve a seat at the table to say, hey, we have some recommendations.
So not just scholars and journalists.
No, practitioners. Because we can tell you exactly why something doesn't work.
Well, you have written this book to enlighten us and help us to understand, if we have not been through it, how we might help people. I mean, Chico, I just loved our community because we opened our doors. Somebody who didn't live here said, well, wasn't that inconvenient that people from Paradise evacuated to Chico? I said, no, we welcome them. And that made me proud to live in Chico.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, Nancy, I had a goal not to cry in this interview. But yeah, I mean, there is not a single person in all of, I want to say, our community in Butte County and beyond, there's not a single person who didn't not feel this, right?
You know, my favorite sentence in your book, the very last sentence, and I want you to, do you remember word for word what you said? In the last sentence in your book is?
My definition of recovery is love.
I loved it. Thank you, Katie,
for writing thank you, this Nancy. Book. It's an honor to be here.
My guest has been Katie Simmons, and she's a local writer, and her book is Three Fire Mountains, Stories of Wildfire and Recovery in California. Thank you, Katie.
Thank you, Nancy.
And next we have a segment we call The Writer's Room, and it features writers from around the North State.
The home I never felt again. You once here, in front of my eyes, stood before me like an angel in the skies. Your smile was as if Cupid blessed you himself. Then you left. I tried to write, I tried to call, but the kinescopia was too much to bear. I drowned in an ocean of you when I just wanted to float. I wish you called me back, Angel. Written by Leah Kammer.
Love Song to Granada. My wallet went on a journey over cobblestone streets, past autumn's maples, by a river. Phoenicians and Greeks traded here. Today, my empty pocket gasped. I reached down and squeezed, found nothing. This thief was quiet, shooting star quick. Driver's license was gone. Passport was my sole ID. It might be stolen, too. 5,000 miles from home. Health cards vanished. Slippery stairways could hurl me down. I had no parachute. I stumbled into fear where Rome wrestled Carthage. Hey, pickpocket, are you sick and poor or some teen craving funds for McDonald's and dope? You gave me a lousy evening with Christmas lights. And fear, Islamic palace high on a hill, later seized by Christian troops, watched over awe. Many poor folks live here, plaza jugglers, singers, the legless man who scowled and moaned, the generous street sweeper who found you, wallet, cowering in some gutter, gave you to the cops, then disappeared into shadows. What's your name, kind one? What joy can I share with you here where Garcia Lorca's home mourns him and the other thousands who Franco slew? Relieved, safe, I climb brick streets, past stone houses, gaze into the mountain's clouds, let drizzle cool my fear. Paella and wine restored me. Keep the 100 euros. I still love Granada. Paul Belts.
War over Brussels. Brussels sprout haters were impassioned debaters, arguing the fate of the sprout. They shouted and roared, and some did implore, throw all these vile veggies out. Brussels sprout lovers were sisters and brothers. They swooned over every yummy bite. God gave us this veggie, we are oh so ready to eat it every day of our life. The leader of each band, a radical man, vowed to uphold their cause. Exclusive clubs formed and cults were born. Advocates beamed with applause. Word got around and soon they all found opponents filling a room. With ire and hate, it was simply fate. A melee erupts in a boom. The clash of convictions caused terrible friction, bursting like an emotional bomb. The dust and dirt caused everyone to hurt. Then came the eerie calm. Out of the tempest, a savior appeared, calm and loving, but must be revered. To some he was Buddha, to some he was JC, to some he was Allah, to some she was Kali. Find common ground with those all around, the Messiah's declared with profusion. Look into their eyes and you will find, we are all truly human. The silence remained until one soul proclaimed, I like carrots and peas. Both sides agreed with nods of a new creed. Hurrahs and cheers so loud. Hugs abound, a new peace was found. The Sprout War is way over now. Drew Tech.
This one's called Friend Tending. The intimacy of grooming poppies in late fall, sloughing away spring's death to make room for second shoots. Gently, fingertips search for the ends of the old to break them without damaging root, soft blue leaves bending in trust. This is what people grew up for, to play with leaves, strands of living like a friend's hair, to brush the wild with softest touch, to braid wordlessly into one. Emma Miller.
For more information on the writers you've just heard, go to mynspr.org and click on the poetry link.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.